Hello and welcome to Dialect for the week beginning Sunday, the 26th of February. I'm John Peters Coleman, and today I'll be interviewing Vivian Keniston. She's part of the Fair Trade organisation, and we'll be discussing the upcoming Fair Trade Fortnight that's coming up soon. This week we also hear about last year's discovery of lost plays and other papers of Bristol's world-renowned Edwardian expert on all things Gothic and supernatural, the Right Reverend Montague Summers. Also, as the industrial age passes away, we look at alternative living at Springhill Co-housing in Stroud and also at Ashleyvale Self-Build in St. Werburgh's here in Bristol. Also, Michael Noyce has another one of his sofa sessions coming up. We chat to a musician called Dan Brown. Malcolm Grieve reads this week's episode of Treasure Island, and we have the weekly What's On Guide and Song of the Week from Jeff Sparks. Dialect is produced by volunteers and broadcast from Bristol, BCFM 93.2. We also go out on Preston FM and Swindon FM, so hello to you, and also in St Albans on Radio Verulam. If you want to join in, if you're in Bristol, contact Volunteering Bristol. The office is just off Queen Square, and if you put in Volunteering Bristol in a search engine on the internet, you will also find them pretty quickly. Dialect recommends the volunteer-run Bristol Bullywatch Helpline. It's aimed mainly at school children and parents, and if you think that's something that involves you, then ring 01454 318 753, and we'll have a reminder of the phone numbers for both Volunteering Bristol and Bullywatch at the end of the show. Over the last century, one of the world's leading authorities on the supernatural, as well as world expert on cannibalism and vampires, was the son of a Clifton banker, a one-time curate in Bath and Bitton, the Reverend Montague Summers. He died just after World War II, but his writings about those who abandon God and open the forbidden doors to the other side on vampires and demonology live on. Montague Summers' papers include his lost play about a notorious counterfeiter disappeared in the 1950s, but it resurfaced about a year ago in the United States. Dialect's Tony Gosling tracked down the finder. A bookseller called Ian Kahn, who is a proprietor of Lux Mentis Books in Portland in Maine, Ian explained how Montague Summers' lost papers came into his hands last year and where the archive is now.
My name's Ian Kahn. I own Lux Mentis Booksellers. I knew Montague Summers only in passing and directly related to, you know, a boyhood interest in werewolves and vampires, having, if you will, all but forgotten about Montague. Out of the blue, one day, I received a direct message on Twitter, of all places, from a scholar who said, in a series of 120-character messages, I've spent a decade or so searching for Summers' archive that was lost in the 1950s, and told me that he had located it, had been working on a follow-up article to Sewell's piece in The Antagonist about Boss of the Archive, and that he had found it and that he was doing this, and the family that had it would like to see it placed in an appropriate home, if you will. That led to it ultimately coming to me and then to Georgetown University, where it's now part of their Special Collections Archive.
Did it come across the Atlantic, or was it already over in the U.S.?
It was already across the sea. It was here. It was purely serendipitous. This gentleman followed me on Twitter, of all things, knew I was in the trade, knew I had an interest in archives and unusual material. He contacted me to see if I was interested, and if not, if I could help them figure out where it should go.
When it arrived, how big was it? What sort of condition was it in?
It arrived in 5 banker box size cases. If you talk to John Buchtel, who is the head of special collections at Georgetown, and I would strongly encourage you to if you're going to kind of bring this full circle, you should touch base with him, because that's where it is now, and he can kind of put the cap on it, so to speak. It had clearly been in damp quarters for some portion of its life. I had to go through it and quarantine a bit of mold, frankly. I know that Georgetown is actually, before they install it into their archives, they are actually going through one sheet of paper at a time. They are cleaning and decontaminating every sheet, one by one.
So when you say a banker's box, how big is that?
A banker's box is about 15 by 12 by 20. ish. Well, yeah, I guess 9 by 12, my wife points out, which is to say about the size that a case of paper comes in.
Can you just give us just a couple of maybe your favourite things that you came across in there? I noticed you put one of his letters up online, which was complaining about the fact that his typewriter hadn't been repaired very well by a so-called typewriter repairer.
That was definitely high up there. I love that. The beauty of a lot of this kind of archival material is that you really see many different aspects of someone's life. I love that letter because it was just great, you know, a sharp mind annoyed by a very petty thing. My personal favorite item, he had written a play about William Henry Ireland, the famous forger, but it was never published, it was never performed. The original manuscript and two copies for this play were all part of this archive. What I think is a genuinely important lost work has been found, and if things go the way I hope they go, someone at Georgetown will actually perform it. It would be, I would make a special trip down to D.C. just for that. He was a literary figure. He wrote on and about the Gothic novel. He was, depending on who you spoke to, clergy or lay clergy. There's some dispute as to exactly what hat he wore. He has an interesting personal life, which ran the gamut from the sharp, witty writer to some rather dark and debaucherous corners, shall we say. He's most famous because of his writings on werewolves and vampires. We've probably gone a generation or two where no one knew who Montague Summers was. Between Stephanie Meyer's and Twilight, where she quotes him heavily, to mainstream media, there was an episode, I think, of Criminal Minds that opened with a quotation from Vampires and Their Kin. He is an interesting and enigmatic historical figure and writer.
That was bookseller Ian Kahn talking to Dalek's Tony Gosling about the recent discovery of papers relating to Bristol's great Edwardian eccentric, Montague Summers. The Right Reverend Montague Summers was writing and publishing from his home in Clifton during the First World War, becoming one of the greatest editors and collectors of Gothic ghost stories, as well as an acknowledged world expert on the supernatural. For many young people now, the dream of owning their own home is beyond their reach. Some have taken the initiative and decided to build their own homes. It's not an easy decision, but well worth the effort if you're keen on DIY. Dialect's reporter Anthea Page went to a local seminar to find out more.
Hello, what's your name?
My name's Jackson Moulding, and I live in Bristol.
Tell us about your self-build.
Okay, we set up about 10 years ago a project in St. Werburgh's in the heart of Bristol to create the opportunities for people to be able to build their own home, which would be more affordable than having to buy a house in the area at the time. We took on a site that's about 2.1 acres, and it was a privately owned site before, so the local community got together to find a way to raise the money to buy the site, which we went through that process. And before there was a community group, as a collection of people, a community group was set up to take on the process of buying the site and to look at the opportunities of doing a project on the site. A self-build seemed to be a very good way of being able to deliver a project. A couple of guys nearby had already done a self-build, and they were very strong advocates saying, yeah, self-build is a great way of people being able to have an affordable home. So that was the pathway that we went down, because obviously there was a fairly hefty price tag to the site, so we had to raise some money to do something with the site. The site was divided up into 20 self-build plots and into 6 units that were going to be delivered by a housing association. And there was an existing office building at the entrance of the site that was going to be renovated into workspace and art space. Well, before the project progressed, we went through a sort of a slight planning process. We had to obviously get planning permission to do the project. There's quite a long history, and trying to sort of wrap it up in a couple of minutes, quite tricky. actually, if people want to read more about it, we do have a website which is called www.wildgoosespace.org.uk, and so people can go to there and have a look at that. But effectively, we've ended up with 20 self-build plots. The 6 units in the middle were done as self-finished housing, and the large office building, 1960s office building, was renovated into 6 self-finished flats, and that was delivered as a common hold. So the 6 members, or the 6 parties for each, one party for each flat, the 6 parties and the community group managed the delivery of the shell in terms of insulating the shell, replacing all the windows, building a new story on the top. And then the community group was left with the ground floor, which it then created a community space and some workspace.
What do you think puts most people off self-build? Is it that they don't know enough about it?
I don't think there is a big put-off from self-build. I think there's a lot of people want to do self-build. There's a huge demand for the publications, self-build publications that are out there. There's a huge audience that watch programmes such as Grand Designs. There's a very strong appetite for self-build. And currently there is probably about 15,000 self-build units delivered each year. Now, there are hurdles that prevent people from doing it. One is access to finance. Another one is access to land. If those two hurdles are dealt with, then there's complications in terms of building control and planning that can be preventative. Now, there is a movement at the moment of trying to resolve some of those hurdles. So the current government is looking at trying to find ways to bring land forward. They are also looking at producing a revolving fund. Both of these things are what we've requested through the National Self-Build Association, which we set up with the objectives of being able to speak with central government and to get them on board in terms of understanding the benefits of self-build.
Could you give people some idea of how much it costs in comparison to, say, buying it off a private developer? How much per square metre?
Well, the cost of a self-build project is very difficult. The opportunity of a self-build, it allows the person who's building a home to design and create a home that's within their budget. There is obviously a further benefit that if you had the same house built by a developer, then you would be paying the profit margin that the developer would want to be taking. So there is a benefit of doing your own project, but the key benefit is that you can design a home that is suitable to your budget and to your needs, and that's the fundamentals of it.
So if you get a plot of land, can you then take your time, say, save up and do the foundations and save up a bit more and put the walls up, etc., etc.?
Well, I guess it depends where that plot is. You know, if you're out in a field somewhere, then you can probably do what you want, and, you know, as long as you've got planning permission. And then obviously there are discussions around that at the moment. You know, there's a very strong movement of trying to create low impact dwellings, which give people a chance of having a very low cost home that has, you know, using local materials from that area that doesn't cost very much in terms of the creation. Obviously, if you're delaying your process of build and you're in a community area where other people are impacted by this, a house that's in constant progress, then, you know, obviously that's going to impact the people around you. But the ability to start a project and get the shell up, you can do that quite quickly, and then obviously you can progress elements of it in due course. There are restrictions about moving into a house before it's completed, and there are also, you know, issues about getting it signed off and making it, you know, legally compliant. The whole process of having the ability of being involved yourself is you can choose to what level you want to go. You know, you can build a large, huge oak frame building that costs millions, or you can build a very simple, small, low impact dwelling in the grounds of a farm or something, if you've got permission to do that, or you've built it very small, so, you know, you fall within the normal permitted development. You know, so part of it is just allowing people to control of the design and the process of creating their own home, and that's, you know, that's the key to it. And people can then choose to what level they want to go to.
So could you just give us the website again?
Yeah, the website I gave before was for the for the Ashley Vale project, but it's www.wildgoosespace.org.uk. There's also the National Self Build Association, which is www.nasba.org.uk. There's a whole host of them. There's also Ecomotive, which is ecomotive.org. And there's also communitybuild.org.uk. And all those websites will give you more information on doing a self-build or community-led housing project.
That was Anthea Page, and she was talking to Jackson Moulding about the practicalities of self-build housing. If you go north of Bristol, about 35 miles, you will come across Stroud. And around Stroud, we have the Spring Hill co-housing project. Dialect's Tony Gosling tracked down one of the residents of Spring Hill and spoke to him about the Green Town's pioneering housing project.
My name's Nicky Ferguson, and I'm from Spring Hill, which is a co-housing development in Stroud in Gloucestershire. Co-housing is something that developed in Scandinavia. There are many thousands of co-housing schemes now around the world, Scandinavia, Canada, the USA. The principles of co-housing are that there should be a common facility, we call it a common house, at the centre of the development in terms of geographical location, but also socially at the centre of the development. And in our common house, we have a kitchen and a dining room. We also have a meeting room where plays happen and concerts and yoga and meditation and all sorts of other things. We also have a games room and a laundry and a workshop in the common house. So that's one principle, that there's a shared facility which is an extension of people's living rooms. That's the way that we look at it. And the other thing is that although there is a main street, the cars aren't allowed on it. So the vehicles are kept on the periphery of the site, which allows children to play freely on the site. But it also introduces a level of sociability because you're forced to walk through the development to get to where your car is parked, and on the way you bump into people, you go past the common facilities. So there's a kind of level of sociability which is built in architecturally to the design of the site.
Now, what's the point of living like that? Most of us live in, you know, maybe a terrace street, that kind of thing, where you see your neighbours quite a bit anyway.
Well, if you can imagine knowing quite well, in fact, being on first name terms with the 34 nearest houses to you, all of them, of course, they may not all be your best buddies. You may not even get on with some of them, but you know them well enough to help them out if they're locked out or their drain's blocked, or give them a cup of tea or whatever. And you know what's going on. Not only that, but once a month you get to cook with a randomly selected group of four of your neighbours, and you get to do gardening weekends and other activities around the site, and you run into them socially as well. So there's a degree of sociability. I wouldn't call it exactly communality because everybody has their own kitchens and their own self-contained house, but there's a degree of sociability built into the development, and it gives it quite a unique feel while at the same time being very accessible. So it's not a commune. You don't have to give up any of your personal space, but it's more like people's notion of a traditional village where people are very much involved in the life of the community.
If you were to sell your house now, would you make money on the original amount that you invested?
Well, we certainly didn't buy it as an investment. We bought it to live there. But yes, it's certainly kept its value. And in fact, the houses are all worth more than they were when they were built. I mean, that's probably partly a function of the housing market. But it's also, I think, a function of the fact that there's a kind of low overhead. You don't have to participate very much, which makes it easy for people to move in and move out. There's no vetting procedure. You don't have to come before a committee to approve your application. So because it's easy to move in and move out, we don't have a waiting list, but we have a long, long list that we call the interested list. And there's about 90 people on it who are interested in moving in should a house come up and they are able to move there at that particular moment in their lives. So, yeah, I think that it's certainly been successful in that narrow sense financially, as well as being successful as a kind of sociability experiment.
Stroud is an interesting little town, isn't it? Because hundreds of years ago, it was the sort of cradle of the Industrial Revolution. There was a lot of innovation going on in Stroud. Do you think this is really, you know, another piece of innovation from that little town in Gloucestershire?
Yeah, I think that's right. In fact, at the turn of the last century, there was a housing development just outside Stroud called White Way Colony, which was developed by a bunch of free thinkers and anarchists who eschewed the idea that anybody should have any ownership of land or houses and refused to have deeds to their houses and so on. So there's a local history of doing things a bit out of the ordinary. As you say, Stroud is an interesting place because there is a kind of alternative feel to some of Stroud, but there's also a very real working town feel to it. It was a mill town. It's not a sort of airy-fairy place, although lots of interesting things are happening there.
If listeners find themselves in Stroud, are they allowed to walk through Spring Hill to have a look?
It's much better, because we get a lot of people who want to come, it's much better to have a look on the website, and then if you want to come and visit, there's an email address on the website. We have regular visitors' days where you can not only walk around the outside of the site, you can actually come in inside the houses, have a chat and a piece of cake and a really good nose around. So that's the best way to do it, rather than just coming on spec. Arrange with the visitors' coordinator to come on a visitor's day.
Thank you very much to Dialect's Tony Gosling, who is speaking to a resident of the Spring Hill co-housing project in Stroud. Now, it's my pleasure to introduce Vivian Kinniston to the studio. Hello.
Hello. Real pleasure to be here.
Yes, this is the second time. Eagle-eared listeners may recognise this name from a previous show. Mm. You're involved with Fair Trades, so I suppose the first obvious question would be just to ask, how long have you been involved in Fair Trade?
Well, I've been involved in it for over 10 years in the small town I live in. Bradford-on-Avon, where I live, is one of what is now about 500 Fair Trade towns, which means that the council's come on board and people in the town have made a commitment to keep on working for Fair Trade.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about what that means. I mean, Fair Trade, obviously people think about the coffee and the little logo on the front. But in terms of where the money goes, what does this actually do for people?
Right. Well, most Fair Trade producers are working together in cooperatives. They could also be working in factories or plantations. But in any case, however they came into it, what they get from being in the Fair Trade system is a guaranteed minimum price, which means with commodities which are affected by fluctuations in world price, like coffee, which Fairtrade started with. Poor producers have no security. Producers in rich country have security. You know, they have agricultural subsidies and things like that. Fairtrade gives producers in poorer countries the assurance that they're going to be able to sell their crop, at least for what it costs to produce, and okay, a little bit of profit.
Okay. How do they ensure that? Presumably big corporate producers will be wanting to clamp down on this.
It's trade. It's a market in the normal way. And on our side, it depends on people here asking for fair trade and buying it. Okay. That makes our supermarkets and shops want to source fair trade. So they go through the fair trade system. The whole chain from the farm to the supermarket is monitored in different ways in the rich countries by our national fair trade organisations. In the poorer countries, it's local monitoring, obviously, that takes place within the country. And
is that quite sort of effective if poorer areas, poorer countries have?
Well, where there have been questions about the supply chain and where it has been queried, for instance, in Ghana, where there was a lot of concern about child labour, filmmakers were there making television programmes, and when they traced the coffee back to the coffee beans being grown by very small-scale producers, first they could trace it back to the actual producer. It worked.
Yep.
It was valid. that coffee came from that place.
Yes.
And those people were not using child labour in the sense of children that they'd brought onto the farm who weren't their own children, that they didn't treat like their own children who were more or less treated as slave labour. That wasn't happening in the Fair Trade Network.
Okay. So voting with your feet does work.
It certainly does.
Once people have bought their coffee and bananas, what then?
Well, the theme for Fair Trade Fortnight this year, and Fair Trade Fortnight runs from the 27th of February to the 11th of March this year, mm-hmm. it's kind of the big campaigning opportunity. It doesn't mean that people don't go on promoting fair trade the whole year, but it's a good sort of national focus for events.
Okay, yeah.
The theme this year is take a step for fair trade, and we're encouraging people to make a pledge to do a bit more than they do already. When I started thinking about the pledges that people could make, for instance, without leaving your local shopping area, you could pledge that you'd never buy a banana that wasn't fair trade, because at least two of the big supermarkets have exclusively fair trade bananas. You could make a pledge to try a fair trade wine or a fair trade beer, which are available in lots of shops.
Okay.
The co-op has beer, lots of shops have wine. You could pledge that when you're out, you'd ask cafes and restaurants if they stocked fair trade, because that's powerful, that's how it starts. You know, if enough people ask, that makes a difference.
Okay, yeah.
And in your favourite food shop, you could just look to see what is fair trade on their shelves. And if there's lots,
are there any particular goods that people might be perhaps surprised to find out are fair trade?
Yes.
Or not?
Well, one of the pledges you could make, you could pledge to buy fair trade toiletries and beauty products.
Mm-hmm.
They're widely available in Boots and Lush and other outlets as well. So
okay.
nearly everybody can access those. And you could, if you really wanted, you could pledge that when you got married, you'd have fair trade gold wedding rings.
Interesting. The production of gold, people may not realise obviously that involves.
It's quite a surprise, yeah. And I couldn't, you know, think how it would work. I knew nothing about how gold was produced.
Okay. So this has been an education.
Before it became fair trade. But a lot of gold is not mined by big companies. It's mined by small individual miners in Africa and South America. Bolivia is where a lot of the fair trade gold comes from. Now I've seen films and pictures of how it happens. And it's small children going down small muddy holes in the ground to get the gold out.
Right, okay. Just cutting back because we're running out of time a little bit. Is there anything else though particularly going on in Fair Trade Fortnight that you particularly like to...
looking at what's happening in Bristol and Swindon, which are both near to us, Bristol's one of the leading fair trade cities in the country.
Okay.
It's got a council-funded coordinator, Jenny Foster, which is a real triumph to have held on to that post in these hard times. And during Fair Trade Fortnight, they're going to have two producers, one from Palestine and one from Nicaragua. And Palestine and Nicaragua are both countries that Bristol has twinning links with. So that's come about. I'm only guessing, probably Nicaragua's coffee.
Okay,
because Nicaraguan coffee is where fair trade started. Okay. And Palestine will be oil and spices.
Okay, and whereabouts is this happening? When is it?
Now, I'd suggest, I'm not going to read the list of events, but I'd say, if you want to know, go on the Bristol Fair Trade website, which is www.bristolfairtrade, all one word, bristolfairtrade.org.uk.
Okay, well, Vivian Kinniston, thank you very much for coming in, and check out the website.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
Our engineer, Michael Noyce, as eagle-eared listeners may know, occasionally does sofa sessions in which he sits a musician down, a Bristol local musician, and gets them to chat a little bit about their music and sings a song. This week it's Dan Brown, who's a local musician, and he chats about his music and why he might also possibly be changing his name.
On my sofa today, I have a singer-songwriter, Dan Brown.
Hello.
I gather you're thinking of going for a name change, though.
Yeah, primarily because when people think of Dan Brown, they associate it with the author, obviously.
The well-known books and a couple of films with Tom Hanks in.
Yeah, exactly. So I just wanted to change it because it's not the kind of thing I
want to be associated with.
Yeah, it's totally irrelevant to what I'm doing.
Yeah. Okay, so are you going for a change of name like John Smith, or are you thinking of like a band type?
More like name. More like a band type name. Well, because I was thinking of going into the studio and having some friends come and go and record different instruments, so making it almost like a group project and calling the whole thing Alter Ego, because different people coming and going, and I just kind of think that'd be more appropriate than Dan Brown.
Yeah, so then you'll perform as alter ego, even though like would be effectively a backing track.
I probably wouldn't. I mean, maybe for big gigs, I'd use a band. But as far as just standard ones, go, I just do it by myself. But still be alter ego, yeah.
That certainly makes sense. So any sort of keywords that would describe your music, rather than genres as such?
More just upbeat acoustic.
Upbeat acoustic, okay. So what is your background? I gather you used to be a drummer.
Yeah, yeah. I started drumming when I was about 11 and did that for about 5 years, 5-6 years. And then I started learning guitar as well. And I was in numerous bands playing drums, but it was only till about 6 months ago I decided I actually wanted to make the leap and change to guitarist / singer. Yeah, I still love drums, obviously, and I still consider myself primarily a drummer, but I also do love playing guitar.
Does that change the approach that you take when you write rhythms? Particularly,
yeah, I mean, I guess so. You think about it in a slightly different way, maybe, because you're looking at your song from a different viewpoint. Because obviously, with growing up drumming and stuff, you kind of you interpret songs differently, and you analyze them and break them down in different ways. That is slightly different to that of being a guitarist.
But it's more of an approach to how you write the song overall, rather than you don't use the guitar as a percussive instrument like, say, Newton Faulkner or Andy McKee or people like that.
No, no, no. It's very much the approach. I don't use the guitar as a drum.
Fair enough. Okie doke. So you've only been playing as a guitarist for sort of 4 or 5 months?
Yeah, I mean, I've been playing guitar for 3 or 4 years, but actually getting out and performing, yeah, since maybe October.
So how have you been getting out there?
I started by doing a load of open mics near where I live, and yeah, just basically just going to as many of them as possible, playing sometimes about 3 or 4 times a week, just going every night, going to different places and playing. And then kind of through that you meet people, and then you can arrange other gigs that aren't open mics, and yeah, just playing, just starting to network almost and meeting new people. And
yeah, so you're all booking your own things, you're not trying to go through promoters or anything?
There's a bit of both at the moment. I'm currently booking my own thing, but I'm currently talking to a certain promoter about booking me other gigs as well.
Okay, so as far as your music's concerned, what sort of things do you write about? I mean, they say you write about what you know, but do you just write about really humdrum things, or is it...
I kind of... It's quite hard to explain, but I quite like things to be abstract and impersonal. I think it's good when you interpret the song entirely as you want to, as in the song's not blatant, it's not obvious what it's about, and that's exactly what I try and do. I try and avoid obvious lyrics and obvious songs. But to be fair, at the same time, I don't think I do that intentionally. It does come out as almost random words, kind of scattered, but not, if that makes sense at all.
So you kind of get maybe an idea of an overall feeling, yeah, from a song. So rather than that, oh, my girlfriend's left me, which is very specific, if you just have a sadder song.
Yeah, exactly.
Someone whose girlfriend has left them might associate with that, but someone who's just sad because something else has happened, the tsunami in Japan, they'll think of that instead or whatever.
Yeah, 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 no, that's precisely it. I mean, in that sense, I like to think the songs are quite flexible because you can adapt them and apply them to a situation. The song isn't about one specific situation. And I mean, where you draw lyrics and stuff from can be totally random. For example, one song I have is written about, well, it's not written about, but I was watching over the summer a TV show called Breaking Bad, and I was just watching this for about 20 hours straight, just that program. And then I just decided to write a song, and I just drew from what I've just been watching for the past couple of days. Not necessarily intentional. It wasn't like, right, I'm going to write a song about this TV program, but it just kind of came out that way.
Okay, and you're actually going to play that song for us now?
Yes.
And what's it called?
It's called Hiding in Plain Sight.
Okay, so this is Dan Brown, Hiding in Plain Sight.
Run round these thoughts in my head. We can't run or forget what I said. We'll run round these streets in my bed. Let me go,
you're always on my leg. My hometown, you've taken me alive. Let me run out from my home. When this little sound, you're taking up my time. Get me in out from my home. Don't tell me that Jess is dead. She was shot, no, but one time in the chest. We'll run round these streets in my bed. Let me go, you're always on my head. My hometown, you've taken me alive. Get me in out from my own. When this little sound, you're taking on my mind. Get me in out from my home. Our little sound, taking me apart. Get me in out from my home. This little town, taking on my mind. Get me in out from my home. My hometown, taking me alive. Get me in out from my home.
That was Hiding in Plain Sight by Dan Brown. And if people do like what they hear and want to come and see you, have you got gigs coming up?
Yeah. So on the 4th of March, I've got The Fleece. And on Saturday, the 7th of April, I'm playing a festival called Rock the Record, which is in Bristol. And it's a 3-day festival. And I'm playing on the Saturday, I believe.
And that's at the Thunderbolt.
Yes, that is at the Thunderbolt. But yeah, usually I'm playing at the Blue Lagoon in Bristol pretty much every week. On that's usually on Tuesdays, and Mr. Wolf's kind of every other Wednesday, and I'm about generally.
Okay, and have you got any kind of website or Facebook page or anything?
Yeah, I have a Facebook page. If you go on Facebook and you search in the magic box Dan Brown Music, I don't actually have a specific URL to that at the moment, purely because I wanted to leave it open because of the name change. You know, it's not in concrete. But yeah, if you just type in Dan Brown Music, I think I'm the first one at the top.
Okay, so Dan Brown, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Cheers.
Thank you very much to Dan Brown, and also to Michael Noyce, and more Safer Sessions in coming weeks. Time for Treasure Island now, and this episode is chapter 33 of the second half of said chapter. It's by Robert Louis Stevenson, and was first published, in its entirety at least, on the 23rd of May back in 1883. Much of the action takes place in 17th century English taverns and bars, some of which are believed to be based on pubs which still exist today. Some of the culprits include Brislington's Hole in the Wall, which may be Stevenson's model for his Spyglass Tavern, and also the Landlord Trow on King Street is often claimed to be the inspiration for Stevenson's Admiral Benbow, although there is a 17th century inn with the same name in Penzance and Cornwall, which also has a similar claim. But anyway, without further ado, Malcolm Grieve reads this week's episode of Treasure Island. Thank you.
and by this time we had reached the gigs. The doctor with the pickaxe demolished one of them, and then we all got aboard the other and set out to go round by sea for North Inlet. This was a run of 8 or 9 miles. Silver, though he was almost killed already with fatigue, was set to an oar like the rest of us, and we were soon skimming swiftly over a smooth sea. Soon we passed out of the straits and doubled the southeast corner of the island, round which, 4 days ago, we had towed the Hispaniola. As we passed the two-pointed hill, we could see the black mouth of Ben Gunn's cave and a figure standing by it, leaning on a musket. It was the squire, and we waved our handkerchiefs to him and gave him 3 cheers, in which the voice of Silver joined as heartily as any. 3 miles farther, just inside the mouth of North Inlet, what should we meet but the Hispaniola, cruising by herself? The last flood had lifted her, and had there been much wind or a strong tide current, as in the southern anchorage, we should never have found her more, or found her stranded beyond help. As it was, there was little amiss beyond the wreck of the mainsail. Another anchor was got ready and dropped in 1.5 fathoms of water. We all pulled round again to Rum Cove, the nearest point for Ben Gunn's treasure house. And then Gray, single-handed, returned with the gig to the Hispaniola, where he was to pass the night on guard. A gentle slope ran up from the beach to the entrance to the cave. At the top, the squire met us. To me, he was cordial and kind, saying nothing of my escapade, either in the way of blame or praise. At Silver's polite salute, he somewhat flushed. "John Silver," he said, "you're a prodigious villain and imposter. A monstrous imposter, sir. I am told I am not to prosecute you." "Well, then, I will not. But the dead men, sir, hang about your neck like millstones." "Thank you kindly, sir," replied Long John, again saluting. "I dare you to thank me," cried the squire. "It is a gross dereliction of my duty. Stand back." And thereupon we all entered the cave. It was a large, airy place with a little spring and a pool of clear water overhung with ferns. The floor was sand. Before a big fire lay Captain Smollett, and in a far corner, only duskily flickered over by the blaze, I beheld great heaps of coin and quadrilaterals built of bars of gold. That was Flint's treasure that we had come so far to seek, and that had cost already the lives of 17 men of the Hispaniola. How many it had cost in the amassing. What blood and sorrow. What good ships scuttled on the deep. What brave men walking the plank blindfold. What shot of cannon. What shame and lies and cruelty. Perhaps no man alive could tell. Yet there were still 3 upon that island, Silver, and old Morgan, and Ben Gunn, who had each taken his share in these crimes, as each had hoped in vain to share in the reward. "Come in, Jim," said the captain. "You're a good boy in your line, Jim, but I don't think you and me'll go to sea again. You're too much of the born favourite for me." "Is that you, John Silver? What brings you here, man?" "Come back to do my duty, sir," returned Silver. "Ah," said the captain. And that was all he said. What a supper I had of it that night, with all my friends around me. And what a meal it was, with Ben Gunn's salted goat, and some delicacies, and a bottle of old wine from the Hispaniola. Never, I am sure, were people gayer or happier. And there was Silver, sitting back almost out of the firelight, but eating heartily, prompt to spring forward when anything was wanted, even joining quietly in our laughter. The same bland, polite, obsequious seaman of the voyage out. Thank you.
That was the second half of Chapter 33 of Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson, and we have one more episode and then we're done. So thank you very much to Malcolm Grieve. Oh, it's my pleasure to introduce our regular poet, Tim Burrows. Hello.
Hi.
Are you doing some poetry? You have brought a jingly-jangly instrument.
Yes, I'm doing some guitar. My voice is a bit funny at the moment, so I've written a guitar piece called Chasing the Dragon's Tail. So,
okay. Is this about opium or something dubious?
No. It's just I thought there's a bit of a chase in it, so I thought, what do you chase? And I thought, dragon's tail.
Ah, so. Cool. Tim Burrows is Chasing the Dragon's Tail. Are you playing anywhere soon?
I'm doing my night at Under the Stars on Sunday.
Okay, the cafe bar on the boat in the centre of town.
Yeah, yep. On Sunday, this Sunday evening, so it'll be after the show. So if anyone wants to drop in and play or listen, there's poets and musicians. Cool. Trevor Carter will hopefully be in.
Okay, what sort of time?
8:30 till 11, and it's free.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Looking rather well dressed in ironed chinos and a collared shirt, which I must say is quite a change from the usual image, Jess Sparks for the What's On Guide.
Thank you, John. Hello, this is your What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 2nd of March, Decapitated will be performing with support from Aborted, Cyanide Serenity and Desecration at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £15 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Also on Friday, 2nd of March, The Beat will be performing at the Victoria in Victoria Road, Swindon. Tickets are £15 in advance and doors open at 8 p.m. On to Song of the Week, and I present Shooter Jennings. He is the only son of Waylon Jennings, and in his career he has released 5 studio albums. This is from the album The Wolf, and is a song titled Slow Train, and also features the Oak Ridge Boys.
So my head hurts so bad that it blows my mind. Every night when I close my eyes, my head hurts so bad that it blows my mind. Got a devil on my shoulder, and that ain't nothing new. I keep it doing what it says, cause there ain't nothing else to do. Boy, if you got the money, I know where to spend it, honey. Gotta get myself straight before I lose my cool.
So ride on a slow train, gonna get back home and tell them where I came from. So ride on a slow train, gonna get back home and tell them where I came from. In my bed, and this age in my brain. The only thing in my days changed is this woman in my bed, and this age in my brain.
That was Shooter Jennings with Slow Train from the album The Wolf, which was released in 2007. For more information, you can check out www.shooterjennings.com. Into Saturday, 3rd of March, The Selector, featuring Pauline Black and Gaps Hendrickson, will be performing with support at The Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £14 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Finally, on Saturday, 3rd of March, Motley Crue tribute The Dirt will be performing at the Victoria in Victoria Road, Swindon. Tickets are £6 in advance and doors open at 8 p.m. That's all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you, Jeff. That's all for this week. Dialect is a weekly podcast for your MP3 player. It's produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Sunday afternoon at 2 p.m. We also go out on Preston FM and in St Albans on Radio Verulam, also on Swindon FM and even in Columbia, we're told. If you're outside Bristol and on the internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, and this will remind you every Thursday when Dialect goes online. You can sign up for that or download this weekly podcast from our website, dialectradio.co.uk. Thank you very much to Vivian Kinniston for chatting about fair trade, also to our poet Tim Burrows and for Jeff Sparks for doing the What's On Guide. The reporters this week were Anthea Page and Tony Gosling. Studio production this week was by Michael Noyce, and the producer was Tony Gosling. I've been John Peters Coleman. Dialects is a Bristol Radio Co-op production, and being a co-op, anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, and you can find them on the web, bristolvolunteers.org.uk. As promised also, if you have an interest in bullying, as a victim rather than perpetrator, presumably, here is the number again for Bristol Bully Watch Helpline, 01454 318 753. That was Dialects, and I'm John Peters Collin, wishing you a very good week. So from all of us here in the Queen Square studio, take care, thank you for listening, and goodbye.
It's in with suits and new recruits. It's bad.